Welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In this episode, we hear from Ella Naruka from the Kirby Institute, Chris Lemieux from the Victorian African Health Action Network, and Daniel Coase from the Federation of Ethnic Communities Councils of Australia, here to talk about the issue of data collection for culturally and linguistically diverse communities. For Health Equity Matters, you're listening to HIV Australia. I'm Justin Salerno, and I'm joined here today by Ella Naruka from the Kirby Institute, Chris Lemieux from the Victorian African Health Action Network, and Daniel Coase from the Federation of Ethnic Communities Councils of Australia, here to discuss the issues of data collection for culturally and linguistically diverse communities. Hi, and welcome to you all. Firstly, could I start with you, Ella? Could you please give us a brief overview of the research project you've been working on and its primary objectives, please?
Thanks for having me today. As we all know, but I'll just give a bit of a background as well to why we did this review in the first place. As we know, a large number of Australians belong to all communities today with the increasing migration, and research into cultural diversity has been attracting a significant attention for all the policymakers and the researchers in Australia. In order to conduct a research about people from multicultural communities or people from all background, collecting the right variables and having the right data is the first important step. To measure the call status of individuals in data collection, ABS had recommended a standard set of cultural and language diversity measures. The set had minimum core, which were mandatory sort of suggestive standards for defining the called population, which was country of birth of the person, main language spoken at home other than English, proficiency in spoken English, and indigenous status. This is the minimum set of core set that needs to be collected to determine an individual's call status. Other than that, optional variables such as country of birth of mother, country of birth of parents, year of arrival, etc. These standards were published in 2019 and the core set recommended. However, it is not always the case that the data sets will be collecting all of them, especially in the health data sets. Data sets omit variables or they just don't feel appropriate to collect them. And this inconsistency in collection of the data variables in epidemiological studies and routinely collected data sets is an issue. Hence, we conducted the systematic review to understand what variables are being collected in the health data sets and are they being used in the studies and in the health research studies in Australia. Do they really align with the ABS standards? And if they don't align, how do they differ? We conducted a systematic search for PubMed, Embase, and NAHIL, and also conducted a grey literature to see the government reports for the last 10 years, which was basically 2014 onwards. And we saw what variables are being used in them to define the called population. We haven't really completed the data extraction, but we are finalizing the data extraction at the moment, and the preliminary findings have shown that none of the health data sets were collecting all the ABS recommended standards. Another important pattern which is emerging in our preliminary findings is that not all variables which are being collected in health data sets are being used to define the called participants for a particular study. For example, some studies are using hospital data sets which collect country of birth, language spoken at home, religious affiliation, proficiency in English, interpreter required, which are great call variables. However, the research is being conducted, if a research is being conducted, then they are only using country of birth or language spoken at home or just four or five of them to define a called population, which might sometimes underestimate the disease burden, as it might potentially misclassify any Australian-born English-speaking person who is from a call background into Australian population. There are other emerging patterns as well. For example, regarding the variables which are being used, the most common variable collected in all health data sets and research studies is country of birth of the person. And as we all know, country of birth of the person is a very weak proxy for called population. Though country of birth might be a very objective variable and hence considered reliable in some way to be collected, just country of birth on its own is not sufficient. Most studies which are using country of birth as only variable to define gold population either used Australian born versus overseas, or they've divided gold into they've categorized gold into main English speaking countries versus non-main English speaking countries. Also, another example I would like to state is the hospital data sets. Some of the studies were using hospital data sets, and they defined under category from gold population, which is seen in the recent studies, is gold having English prof good English proficiency, and the other would be gold with low English proficiency based on what spoken language they provided. The second most common variable was, which are collected in the gold data sets, were language. And some would collect language spoken at home. Some data sets would collect language spoken at home other than English. And though these two may seem a slight variation of the same question, it does change the way people respond to this question by providing information on a form or a survey. So we have found consistency in collecting the language variable and the way the language question was asked as well. Some were asking preferred language, some were asking primary language. So it's really confusing how the language variable is being collected. The last key finding is about ethnicity, ancestry, cultural groups, and cohort groups. All these terms were used interchangeably. Studies where ancestry or ethnicity was collected was most self-identified. There were some inconsistencies in understanding and collection of these concepts too. Some studies were defining ethnicity based on nationality, and some studies were defining ancestry and ethnicity based on their beliefs or the culture they were from. These are not all, but these are some of the key findings which we've observed in the preliminary data extraction. And I would be talking about the definite stats once we have completed the data extraction process. But now, if it's okay by you, Justin, we can talk to our experts, Daniel and Chris, about their thoughts on the issues and the gaps which we've observed in our systematic review.
Thanks, Ella. Yeah, so Daniel and Chris, as you reflect on the key findings presented by Ella, what are your initial thoughts regarding the identified gaps with the NCAL communities?
I'm deferring to Chris, but yeah, thanks, Ella. That's in fact Fecha's experience about the whole data mess in Australia. And in 2020, we put out an issues paper called If We Don't Count, We Don't Count. That paper had a lot of experts, including from Kirby, contributing. And it just tried to set out, because Fecha, there's nobody in Fecha who's a statistician, demographer, epidemiologist, whatever, but we felt it was important to try and document what the impacts of the lack of data were. In terms of service planning, policy development, and that kind of stuff. It was done really at the time of COVID, so it did tend to focus very much on health data. But we now see the, 4 years on now, sorry, 2 years on, we see the need to actually update that. And we're starting that major update to, because some things have changed, but also to make sure we're covering things like the other data relevant to the space that's used in employment, housing, education, social area, and that kind of stuff. Ella's really nailed it in the sense that the standards, the ABS standards for statistics on cultural and language diversity from 1999 are still there with minor revisions, and do propose, as she said, a core set and an additional set. And yes, wherever we go, we see that the mostly consistent variable collected is country of birth, which, as she's explained, is not necessarily helpful. I mean, consider if you just answered country of birth Australia, what could that mean in terms of different cultural backgrounds, ethnicities, cultural identification, that kind of stuff. But think of Singapore, where somebody could be born in Singapore, but be of Chinese heritage, Indian, Malaysian, whatever. Think about all the refugee cultures and groups like the Kurds and the Rohingya, the one in Burma, which are residing across different countries. So country of birth is really the least helpful indicator there could possibly be, and without additional variables, but it remains the only consistently collected variable. And Ella talked about health sets. There were 13 data sets that I looked at from the the HW, and virtually all of them collected country of birth, but only as the sole indicator. AHW is kind of really grappling this in addition to ABS, and you may have seen their report last year on chronic disease prevalence in multicultural communities. And they've recognised for a long time the deficits in the data and are trying to work on this. I think one of I was talking to Ella earlier, and I just think as we I think hopefully embark on this kind of effort to try and sort out this mess, particularly in health, I just wonder if it's worth sitting back a bit and actually saying, what do we need to know? Why do we need to know it? What are the questions we want to ask? You know, because people collect all sorts of data which doesn't necessarily get used. So what are the key issues? So example in the HIV area, what do we need to know? Given our multicultural population, we need to know about infections, frequent uptake, testing, and a whole other raft of issues. And if we had the right indicators, we could then identify populations, if you like, being missed out and not really being caught up in this. And that was a classic thing in COVID. And then I'll shut up, because Fekir advocated very strongly with the government, the then government, to set up some sort of advisory structure for COVID. And that worked really quite well. But out of that came a data group that was looking at it, and particularly around the anecdotal and sort of incomplete evidence about low willingness to for vaccine uptake. They had to use, complex processes of data integration. That there used to be the MARDIB project, now it's PLIDAR, run by the ABS, where they can take data from all over the place. Expensive, time-consuming, very serious as to who can actually access it and use this and whatever. But as a result, they were able to, it was never published, obviously, for obvious reasons, they could go drill down into local government areas as to language groups that weren't then being captured by the vaccination program. And part of the problem was the National Notifiable Diseases Surveillance System, which also deals with HIV, Hep C, and other things. The only indicator in that whole system about any sort of diversity is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. And I was amazed at how quickly it was happened, but we were able to persuade them to, and they did. They added on a two indicators: country of birth, and preferred language spoken at home. And that was supposed to be on the vaccination consent forms, and it took a long while for that to happen. And then when the data collected through that process was going to be uploaded to the Australian Immunisation Registry, not possible because the registry didn't have those fields. So in addition to a discussion about what indicators we would best capture this, it's then about that whole interoperability of the systems and state and jurisdictional reporting mechanisms and how it gets consolidated, consistency in collection and reporting. Because even in the latest, back from 2020, that surveillance and monitoring framework, there's very little CALD indicators there at all. So it's kind of like, how do we break through this? And I think it's about, perhaps, I know this is important in the HIV area, but perhaps it's something we need to think about more broadly in the health sphere, and maybe gather people around to have a serious discussion around it. So sorry, I've taken up too much time, so I'll stop there for the moment. Thank you.
Hi, thanks, Daniel. No, that's, I was really interested in what you had to say there. And also, Ella, I think that idea of not knowing how to speak about things is really a recurring thing. And sometimes it's because it's a sensitive subject and we're afraid to talk about it, I think. So the things that sort of came out at me from what you said there, using proxy measures, so like country of birth as a proxy for, whether it's cultural groups or whatever, rather than direct measures. The difference between labeling and describing and identifying. How a person might see themselves and their relationships in, their social networks and in society would be different to how they might be labeled and categorized by an agency. There's a really big difference between counting them and counting us. There in the UK, quite a few years ago now, there was a really big push by, African and Black British people to be seen in the statistics for HIV, because the people on the ground knew that there was a disadvantage of access to prevention and also to treatment and care, but they were invisible in the statistics. And so when they actually argued for being counted, and they introduced, racial descriptors into their statistics, and all of a sudden they were able to demonstrate the disadvantage and the inequity and then get some resources to help address the issue. That's different in the UK. The situation in the US is different, and the situation in Australia is different as well. We've got Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander identity as a category because we're a settler colonial nation, and that's clearly one big fault line in society. But, we're also a nation that is, has historically had a white supremacist ideology as its founding sort of doctrine, and our migration policy was dictated by that to a large degree. And a lot of the historical legacies of, you know, colonialism shape our migration and settlement patterns and patterns of employment. So, you know, who are the people who are working as nurses and doctors? Who are the people who are working as nail techs in salons? And who are the people working in, you know, other personal services? There's a lot of really distinct migration flows and cultural differences there. And we don't really have the language to describe that with any sophistication at all. And so using those core indicators, I think the ABS has given the tools for everybody to use, but it's on all of us to use them in a way that's helpful and positive. And one size won't fit all. So if we're talking about communication, then language might be really interesting. If we're talking about what diseases or conditions people were exposed to when they grew up, then country of birth might be really interesting. And if we're talking about, you know, diets or other things that have got, you know, strong cultural overlays linked with religion, then religion might be interesting. So it really is what's fit for purpose. And as you said, Daniel, why are we wanting to know? Especially if it's, why are we wanting to know so that we can do something to help ourselves or ask for someone to help us as a community, you know, seeking assistance from government or from health professions and so on, versus what do we want to know about them so that we can control them and preventing them from, you know, being a danger to us, which is historically the position of our migration sort of policy and the way that we describe people in migration terms. It's like an island mentality. So I think there's a long way to go in even having the mental setup to think about these things, and the language we use is going to reflect that. And so it's really good that this conversation is happening in HIV. But as you said again, Daniel, it's the really big question is how that's going to relate to chronic disease, mental health and disability in society, because that AHW report that you mentioned showed that the people in Australia with the worst burden of chronic illness and disability are older European-born people from non-English-speaking backgrounds. They're the people who've had the longest history of missing out on, you know, health promotion and healthcare. And there's successive waves of settlement coming after them who are probably going to face the same issues if we don't change the way things are set up.
The other thing for me is this, when the country of birth is kind of the sole indicator, what surprised me for some time is in this bloodborne virus space is how the focus of national strategies really up till now has been entirely on the overseas born as a priority population in the OCT, in the HIV strategy and others. And you, so there's no capacity in a sense to sort of deal with the issues that cultural, religious, otherwise that might affect people from different backgrounds who are born in Australia. They're not even recognised as a priority in the national strategies. And that came through the Kirby Institute's 2020 The Gaps Project report, where they actually did notice that, you know, that there's currently no way to assess what proportion of new HIV diagnoses for anything else related to HIV are in, if you like, broadly speaking, Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-Celtic Australia, and culled by whatever definition gay men or men have sex with men, and how those trends might have, you know, translated in time. And they're making the point that the ability to disaggregate that in terms of the Australian-born and the Australian-born culturally diverse people, you know, to actually have some way of including these, this in the data is really, I think, quite important, and it's often neglected. So I was hoping to see something coming out of the new strategies on that.
Yeah, it'd be really nice if it did. I think you're right that there's a whole lot of people, I mean, I'm one of them, who have got heritage from overseas, but, you know, when I fill in the census, I'm an Australian-born person with English as my first language, you know, educated largely in Australia. But, you know, I've got an African heritage and have lived overseas and in West Africa for part of my childhood. But that's not going to appear in the demographic stats.
And my point about mentioning the data integration focus at the moment is that, A, that's complex and whatever, but surely that process would be very useful for solving complex problems and delving deep into things that, if you like, some superficial data collection wouldn't get. But to me, why can't a lot of these data projects are reliant on integration because they don't have the key identifiers collected at source, you know, whether it's in GP practice or in hospital things or wherever. So there was just complete inconsistency, which is why the complex data integration progress has become more important.
Yeah, It's really interesting when you talk to people from European countries and about this, because they've got such sensitivity about collecting any kind of ethnicity or race data because of the history there. So it's actually illegal in some places to collect anything about cultural identity in sort of routinely collected statistics. And you can see why, because, you know, historically that data was collected and it was used to label and then, you know, destroy whole parts of the population there. And that memory doesn't go away very easily.
I don't know if you agree, Chris, but I think one of the problems is that in Australia there's not necessarily been an in-depth discussion about what we mean by ancestry and ethnicity and things like that. And language is interchangeable, but there's an interesting conversation about what these terms actually mean. And interestingly, the ABS standards talk about ancestry, and so does the census, which is apparently the most least useful question of all in the census, because people don't get it and understand it, and it's confusing for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people anyway. But that both of the census and the ABS standards, the way ancestry is met, is from another ABS standard called ethnicity. So, but there's an unwillingness to actually use the word ethnicity in the conversation. It's kind of politically difficult. And again, I don't know if you agree, but the other area that I find complex is this notion of race, which is a huge argument about what is the definition and why is it useful and whatever. And I just feel, though, that in terms of the increasing interest in genomics and genetic medicine, whatever, my understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, that, you know, that there are certain biogenetic sort of characteristics associated with race that may render somebody more susceptible to particular diseases. We know, for example, in cancer treatments, the dosage for chemotherapy is just a standard Anglo-Saxon measurement and really knocks some people around, particularly from Southeast Asia and Chinese people, and there needs to be some variation of the appropriate dosage for those kind of reasons. But again, it's very difficult to have a discussion about race in this country.
Yeah, it is, and it's one of those very plastic words that means many different things. When I did my research with HIV in African communities a few years ago, I deliberately asked the question, "Can you, you know, describe your ethnicity?" Because I just wanted to see what people would say. And of course, most people, it was an incomprehensible question that made no sense to them. And I thought that would be the case, and it was. Because, I mean, historically, ethnicity, I mean, its origin is a way of describing foreign peoples who are not part of your group. It's all the different types of other people that there are.
You said ethnic minority.
Yeah. So ethnos was literally, that's what the ancient Greeks used to label the different types of barbarians, because they didn't use that category for themselves. It was about, you know, which city were you from, whereas, you know, all those other mobs, you know, they knew they were all different, but they're all not Greek, so that was the main thing. And race is a really interesting thing too, because it seems to have characteristics of difference and inheritance, but it can be used to describe, like, what's literally ancestry. It can be used to describe, again, like ethnicity, different people, and people can be racialized. So Muslims can be racialized. So that's a social category and it's a religious practice, but people teach religion to their children. And so it's treated as like an inherited characteristic. And so you can be racist against Muslims. And that has been, you know, has happened in Australia. So it's a very plastic concept. And as soon as you try and nail it down, it disappears, but it's also very strong and gets used for, you know, quite for political purposes. The best definition of race I have come across is that it measures exposure to racism. So if that's what you're, you know, because if you're in America, being black is not the same as being black in Brazil or being black in Australia. But if there's anti-black racism, then, you know, if that's your label in that place, then you certainly know when it applies. So I think, you know, and when it gets talked about in terms of ancestry and in genomics and genetics, you can't tell where someone's ancestors came from by looking at them, especially now, but even historically, you know, there are plenty of people who look, you know, like they've got mainly North European ancestry, but they've got African ancestors, they've got Indian ancestors, and vice versa. So I think when you're trying to use it as a proxy measure for something else, you can run into trouble. And the best thing, if you're looking at a genetic characteristic, is to test for the gene. If it's going to affect the dose of a drug or the the chance of having a side effect of a drug, you can test for that gene, whether it's present or not, and that's functional. Whereas if you say, oh, this person, you know, got a bit of a tan, I might change the dose of the medication, that's probably not going to be the best way to go about it.
Chris, I'm just interested in your thoughts on a tendency in health data sets to kind of, whether it's country of birth or other measures, but they, a lot of them tend to aggregate those up into kind of regional things as well. So, you know, looking at the ABS, again, the ABS standards for classification of countries and regions, whatever. So there's like this Asia, Southeast, Northeast, South Central Asia. Quite often we see those statistics being rounded up into Southeast Asian. But when you actually look at what countries and that involves, I mean, Southeast Asia is Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, Philippines, Singapore, Timor-Leste, and you just look at that one, or perhaps even better is South Central, India, Pakistan, Maldives, Nepal, Afghanistan, Armenia, Georgia, etc. You know, just the sheer breadth of cultural, ethnic and diversity within, to what is the use then of, if there is any, Chris, in terms of aggregating them up?
Yeah, it's really like the more you dive into it, the more detailed it gets. I mean, I've looked at a map of the languages spoken in Myanmar, and it's incredibly complex. That one country has got so many different layers of cultural diversity and linguistic diversity. And, you know, that disappears, you know, if you aggregate that at a national level. I think there's no substitute for talking to people and actually building links and relationships with people in communities who have got needs and desires. I think one of the really strong things about the HIV response in Australia is that where those links have been made and communities have actually led, you know, government and the health profession and scientific profession to, you know, meet the challenges of HIV, you know, we've done really, really well. But whenever it's been standing back and just labeling people and, you know, formulating policies and allocating resources without actually talking to them, we run into real trouble.
I remember with the CALDA, the Health Equity Matters, formerly of FAO, started off their CALDA affiliates and partners group. And there was a lot of discussion around the data. And it struck me that this conversation at the service level, you know, and the members of that group who are actually there on the ground in clinics providing services, they know, you know, who their particular patients can tell around what their particular needs might be. So they're aware, but then a lot of that gets lost in this translation of data at the higher level, at the national level. And so again, that's, I think what I'm saying is we just need to be very clear as to why we nationally need those data and what would be the best indicators, and the importance, as Chris said, of talking to people, so that in any data collection, I think it's important to explain to people why we would need these data. And it's probably about trying to make things better for you, that you, you know, your needs get heard and that kind of stuff. So I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And the thing that sort of strikes me is that no set of indicators is going to be fit for everybody's purpose. But if we do collect data that's intelligible to other people, then we can work together. So the main thing, I think, is if we can be in communication, you know, that's communities, you know, health professionals, researchers, government. If we do have at least the same vocabulary, we can say things that are understandable to each other, so that, you know, if someone says ethnicity, or if someone says race, or if someone says language, at least we know what we're talking about, and we know that we're kind of meaning the same thing. Or alternatively, we all agree that, you know, a word has so many different meanings that there's no point in using it, because no one will know what we mean when we say that. So we have to get more precise terminology.
I think I'm sure you're aware of the Race Health Observatory in the UK, which is part of the National Health Service. Yeah, and they conducted a huge survey a while ago about terminology, asking thousands of them how they like to be described or referred to. And it's a very interesting conclusion that their conclusion was that there was no answer. And there were so many variations that some people were happy to be aggregated up and some people wanted to be very specific. And it was so the only thing that they could come up with at the end was that in all their publications or work, whatever, they will use the term that was most appropriate for that particular exercise, respect it. So,
that's really probably the conclusion, isn't it? That's probably the conclusion is speak to people in a language that you mutually understand in a way that's respectful and helps you do what you need to do. That sort of seems to be the main thing. I love it is a bit of a tangent, but that idea about, you know, so-called main English speaking countries or English speaking countries. And I'm always, you know, slightly amused when India is not classified as an English speaking country, for example, when it's got more English speaking people than any other place in the world.
Yeah, you've reminded me of that main English speaking countries, which apparently, which still has South Africa as one of them, and used to have a lot of the African the British colonies in Africa as part of them. So it's a whole colonial vestige as to who they are. But it's still used. So looking at the annual reports on government services, you are technically CALD if you were born overseas in a non-language speaking country. And the same for the NDIS, where they do actually have a language indicator thrown in. But apart from what you said, if you like, about India, but think about the, and it's happened, we've spoken to these people, the Indian family that moved to the UK in the, you know, in the 70s, they've got children who are born there, brought up there, who speak English with a broad Liverpool accent. They come, some of them come out here and, you know, speaking, so therefore perhaps don't have some of the issues of finding the right services and that kind of stuff in terms of English language proficiency. But in any data collection, or, you know, that I've mentioned, they're not culturally linguistically diverse because they were born in the UK, which itself is increasingly diverse. It's just a nonsense.
Yeah, it's a sort of a fiction in a way, isn't it? It's like a fantasy world. I mean, when in the research that I was doing, some research on the experience of mainly people from Afghan backgrounds in COVID in the southeast of Melbourne. And the terminology we settled on for that was English dominant countries, because I think it's not so much whether it's spoken, it's whether it's in a dominant position and other languages are put in a subordinate role in the society, because that sort of leads into, you know, systematic discrimination and exclusion, and then does present, you know, those inequities which have health and well-being outcomes in society.
Yeah, so how are we going to make these conversations happen? The original FECA data issues paper I referred to was proposing that there needs to be some sort of national-led initiative around this. And the current Multicultural Affairs and Migration Minister, Andrew Giles, has been fairly sympathetic, but he's very busy on other things at the moment. But he did commit that the government would be looking at this. And there was some initial work done through Home Affairs, which is questionably useful. But one of the things we were actually asking for was the national summit, rather like the Jobs and Skills Summit a couple of years ago, where, you know, you could actually have players in the room. And we saw that summit as being broader than just health issues. But the key thing, because there's similar issues in everywhere, education, as I said, employment, Centrelink, you know, where is the consistent data in those kind of spheres as well? So we had this notion that a national sort of two-day summit or something should be informed by a series of roundtables from the different sectors as to trying to get back to that question I was proposing. What do we need to know and why? And therefore, what might be the useful indicators? So hopefully something might happen before too long.
So I just have a quick question for you both. Is in that ideal world of data collection, at least in routinely data collection of health data sets, do you think collecting all the ABS indicators, both the minimum and the suggestive, having all of them collect, at least should be a first step collecting them, and then the why side of the questions can be dealt later, where people, what are they looking at, the why side of things, and then they can pick and choose the variables to define that population and answer their question. But at least having those variables there and having the data collection there should be the first step. Like in an ideal world, I know it's a long way to get all of them, all the indicators, country of birth of parents, country of birth of mother, father, and all the year of arrival. It's really a long way because I don't think any of the health data set except hospital data sets collect more than two indicators at the moment. So compiling them all will be a long road. But do you think that's the first step, at least working towards that direction?
I think that'd be challenging because for a couple of reasons. One is that people like to know why their information is being requested. And if someone can't see the immediate relevance of it, then they'll either refuse to answer, or they may say something that's not true, or they may just have a really negative reaction to whoever's asking them the question. So I think there is a risk, apart from the sheer workload of routinely collecting data that someone someday will use for something, there is the risk of it actually becoming low quality data because people don't know why it's being asked of them. I think what might be good though is to be conscious of what could be asked, you know, like there's a whole menu, and then what's going to be asked, you know, right here, right now for this reason. So that at least we know what else we're not asking, and it's a conscious choice as an agency or as a researcher, as a service provider, so that when you go back to see where the holes are in the data, you know where the holes are and you can go and fill them rather than it just being a vague mess, which is the current situation.
I agree. And even the ABS and the explanatory guide to using those standards, 99 standards, really talk about, you know, they're not actually prescribing necessarily what indicators should be collected in any consideration, because it depended, if you like, on the context and what the data was going to be used for and how informative that would be. But I think, though, however, in health, for example, part of the problem, as we said, is inconsistent data collection and gaps in reporting, and that there's very little often, then they're not comparable because of all sorts of reasons, but whether there was in some aspects of health just really agreed minimum data in the space. And as Chris says, if there's other things you want to find out, there are other ways of doing that through the data linkage projects and that kind of stuff. But at least have some core valuable data that was consistent across the country, I think would be valuable. I mean, earlier you talked about hospital data sets, which are different from general practice data sets, which are different from, you know, all sorts of other things. And national registries of diseases like the cancer registry and whatever, it's just so completely inconsistent that you wonder how useful it is. But your point about actually talking to people about why they need this data, I think a good example was when they brought in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander self-identifier. That was just so difficult for many, many years, people not wanting to fill it in, not wanting to be discriminated against, whatever. But it's just very interesting with those conversations that have gone on that my understanding is that data is much more readily given, and, you know, quite significantly better given, as people, I think, are getting to understand what the purpose of that is, which is really about trying to make things better.
Do you think a self-identifier for COLD population would help as well?
In the paper originally, we didn't go as far as saying there should be. We thought there might be a useful conversation to be had about that. But it would be very complex in terms of what language was used. We've already talked about different understandings of ethnicity, culture, race, and all that.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, bearing in mind, we tend to forget too that there's also considerable cultural and language diversity in Aboriginal communities anyway. You know, that tends to get overlooked, that they're similar to multicultural people in Australia. They're not necessarily homogenous in many ways, but yeah, how useful that would be. But it was and therefore if somebody was, the only question was, yes, I identify as, well, what does that actually tell us in terms of tractable things we might need to know, particularly in the health space, to be able to respond more appropriately and to plan services better?
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting about self-identification. Sometimes it's really, really important and sometimes it's not. One thing I suspect is that wherever that there is an issue of difference, there is already language being used to describe it. And some of it's polite, some of it's really not, but there are already words that are being used. And probably, you know, in practical terms, one thing to do is to use the language that's already being used, but to critique it and to define it. So that if people are saying, oh, that group, we call them that, we call ourselves this, you say, okay, well, who does get those labels? You know, are there people who are both? Are there people who are neither? What do you mean when you call yourself this, and what do you mean when you call them that? And why do you do that? And what are you trying to achieve? And I think if you're engaged with a community or in a place where these labels and identities are being actively discussed, there's always a reason for that. And if that's tied up with why you're there, whether it's health or education or justice or whatever, use that language. But then if it's defined, then you can progress from, you know, if the language itself is harmful or it's causing more problems, then you can evolve and develop new language. If the language is helpful, you can capitalize on that. So I think it's hard to be prescriptive about it, but being descriptive about it is very helpful.
I'm just beginning to wonder whether it's the time for my organization, the Federation of Ethnic Communities Councils of Australia, to examine its name. But again, in context from that period when it was set up, you know, 40 years ago, where it was very much, you know, Greek-Italian migration at that time, that's how they describe themselves. And some still do, you know, like I'm ethnic Australian or I'm an ethnic. And in some groups, it's not necessarily seen as pejorative, but in others it is.
I sort of like the honesty of it in a way, because it is a problematic word, but it's because there was a problem. The word didn't create the problem. It was a response to the problem. And the problem was there was a lot of racist prejudice against people from Southern European backgrounds who came to an Anglo-Australia, you know, and that's what the problem was. The word evolved as a response to that. And sometimes it's good to keep that history there and, you know, remind ourselves what we're actually trying to achieve.
Just on the issue of self-identification, you're probably aware of the work of the Diversity Council, Diversity Council Australia. They did a project called Counting Culture, which was around a set of tools for employers to be able to measure cultural diversity in their workspace. And they actually played with and have, to some extent, what I think is the first attempt I've seen at kind of a self-identifier, but in that context. It might be good to have a look at that. All right. Sorry, Ella, we've just been necromantic.
To wrap up the podcast, I guess what were the final recommendations would you offer to policymakers, researchers, and community organizations aiming to enhance data collection?
I think listen, go meet people and listen to them and find out what language is being used, what words are being used, and try and see how that matches up with, you know, other ways of describing people and try and make sense of it for a purpose in that place. And then you can sort of build on the past. I think going in with a catalogue of labels and then trying to force people to fit into a box, probably not the way to go about it.
Yeah, that's really a good point, because I'm aware of 6 to 8 national projects in the health sphere at the moment grappling with this issue, and the main focus tends to be testing out particular indicators. And I think it would be good to get at least those people together in a room to discuss what's happening, to share learnings, and to, because there's a risk of duplication and everyone going off in their own direction, but can we try and bring a space together for people to discuss it? But I think you're right. What's missing for me, I'm sure it doesn't happen with Kirby because they're so good, but where is the voice of the people we were trying to describe in these ways, in those conversations, even in those particular research projects? So yeah, the kind of conversation, as Chris is suggesting, is important, I think, is really worth promoting.
Me, I think it was really interesting to hear, because I usually work with the data side of things, but the people side of things is really important as well. As you said, just answering the why side of question before the what is more important. So you need to know why you are collecting this data, and then I think the what becomes much more easier. So yeah, I'm actually now go and finish the data extraction of the review, and then maybe we can talk about more what comes out as a solid indicator than the gaps as well in that review. But I think, yeah, as you said, Daniel, having a centralized place where all these projects which are working in silos can come together and discuss the gaps and the problems they are facing and then face them together. Because if you're working in the same direction, why not work together?
I'm a bit nervous about the word centralized, that there's some sort of centralized control around this, because I think it's important that different ideas and ways of doing things are tested. But it's kind of like, can we bring everyone together to have a conversation about what some of the learnings have been and what the gaps are and how we actually progress all this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Daniel, Ella, and Chris, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. That was really interesting.